Patch Monday this week, digital anonymity. Do you have a right to be anonymous online? When should you have to reveal your identity and when should you not? Hi, I'm Still Gerrion for ZDNet Australia, probably. Well, last week I took part in a panel discussion on online anonymity organised by Media 140 Australia. It covered a lot of material. Being anonymous online in Syria or Egypt is a good thing if you're trying to change the government there, right? But what about if you're trying to change the government here in Australia or in the US? Suddenly that's viewed as being some sort of dangerous radical, possibly even a criminal. Is speaking freely under a pseudonym something you should do to protect yourself, a sensible practice? Or does that make you an evil internet troll? And what about the commercial angles? Facebook and Google want your real identities, but what if you're uncomfortable with that? Real identities, says Google, make online forums more civilized. But I've got a one-word response to that. Kyle Sanderlands. Yeah, I know that's two words, but the one word I wanted to use was, this is a family-friendly podcast. Now, the Media 140 discussion went for 2 hours, and there's a recording of the whole thing over at media140.com. But in Patch Monday today, some highlights, my personal selection, focusing on the other panellists more than me. Oh, and one thing to note, there's a lot more questions at the end of this than we'll ever have answers. Well, first up, Jessica Hill from ABC Radio Current Affairs. She's been spending a lot of her time maintaining contacts in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East, and obviously staying anonymous is important there. But she also has a very clear view of the central hypocrisy at Facebook and Google and all their friends.
Facebook is allowing companies to anonymously access your data without your knowledge. And they're asking you to be more transparent.
She's also noticed a distinct shift in attitudes to being anonymous.
It's been interesting to see how suspicious people have become of anonymity, because back in the day, it was really no big deal. Everyone had the right to publish anonymously if that's what they felt they wanted to do, if they wanted to disassociate their real identity from the ideas they made public. That was their right. But now, I guess, we live in a fishbowl society and our expectations around privacy have dropped sharply. And I think that we've become far less protective of our right to privacy and conversely far more suspicious of people who want to protect that right.
Indeed, from my point of view, I think the whole question is actually backwards. It's not whether you have a right to anonymity online. It's more the question of when does someone have the right to demand to know who you are, particularly in a digital world where once you have an identity, some sort of digital identifier, you're linked not just with, your name and address and occupation, but with everything that's ever happened online. So just because I want to buy a hamburger, for instance, does that give someone the right to have access to everything I've done online ever? It's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it? Well, another panellist was David Stewart. He's a lawyer. He's from Rays in Perth. And he specialises in things to do with, defamation and all that kind of thing. And here's him describing the first encounter he had with online defamation.
And a client of mine who runs a relatively small business, she exports confectionery and it's doing very, very well, was having an ongoing problem with her landlord. And the landlord was refusing to fix things. She was having water run into her bakery and it was all a bit of a mess. And the landlord's agent was being particularly problematic. And I think there might have been a bit of tension between the two of them, because the next thing you know, on Facebook, he started complaining to his friends about what a pain in the ass she was, described her in much more incendiary terms than that, and then encouraged all of his friends to go and shoot in her doorway. And some of them did. So we then had the issue of trying to determine exactly how we go after this guy. Defamation seemed to be the obvious angle, and he came back and actually said, "I'm sorry, that actually wasn't me. Someone else actually set up an account using my name, and it actually wasn't me at all. And I also have noticed that this account has now been pulled down. So I'm not quite sure what you can do about that." We end up tracing his IP and determined it actually was him, and he changed his position. Now, to me, I fully understand the importance of freedom of expression. I really do. But within the laws, at least of this country, there are important boundaries around that. And one of them is that you don't go around defaming people and encouraging people to go and defecate in other people's doorways. It's just not the right thing to do.
I'm not sure whether I should mention that defamation and defecation are really only a letter or two apart, should I? Well, look, one of the scenarios I mentioned while I was on this panel was the idea, well, as you perhaps heard, we recorded this at the pub, at the Hotel Clarendon in Surry Hills, as it happens. And everyone there on the night, you know, just turned up at the pub. The publican didn't know who we were and didn't need to know who we were as long as we're happily, you know, buying drinks and food. It only becomes an issue if we become a problem. And at that point, that's when the publican can demand to know who we are or really call the police who demand to know who we are. Well, of course, that's not the case at every pub throughout some of the suburbs of Sydney and I guess in other cities as well. There are pubs that actually take biometric identification of everyone who comes through the door. And what happens there? Well, if you get tagged as being a troublemaker for whatever reason, then you go on their database and you have trouble getting into not only every pub in that chain of pubs, but every pub that uses that particular biometric company. And my questions there are always around, you know, who has access to this, who has training in how to deal with these sorts of issues, and what sort of due process is there? I mean, for example, let's say one night you're a bit rowdy at the pub and get chucked out. But let's say that's because, I don't know, you had a bad day at work, you were sacked maybe, you've just had a divorce, you've just lost a court case, and for whatever reason, you got too drunk and became a problem. Is that sort of thing, a one-off incident, really the sort of thing which we want to stay with someone forever? And I even posited the idea that, well, you know, what if you were, as a kid, a teenager, did a happy slapping video and posted it on YouTube? Should 30 years later that be dug out and suddenly stop you becoming Minister for Education? Now, someone who actually uses all this online data that's collected through Facebook and Google is Carolee Evans. She's from the PR firm Text 100. Now, she had a particular answer to these kinds of scenarios.
If you don't want to have your data captured, don't go into that pub. There's plenty more pubs. If you don't want to have your data captured by Facebook, don't use it.
Well, that's all well and good, but what happens if your local volleyball team organises all of their activities through Facebook? You have a choice. Don't use Facebook, but then don't be a member of your volleyball team as well. And one of the audience members found that to be a similar case, just staying in touch with people.
No, it's okay. I do have a Facebook account, but I've pretty much stopped using it.
Right, tell me why.
Well, because a lot of people I know overseas, the only way I've got contact with them is actually through Facebook, because that's how they talk. But I'd prefer not to use the bloody thing at all, right?
Right. Well, that was the point I was actually making, that you're not the only one with a say in how you conduct your day-to-day business online. And sometimes you will end up with that hard choice. If you want to stay in touch with those friends, then you're going to have to communicate the way they communicate, and that might just mean using Facebook. Well, of course, all of the privacy terms and conditions are online. It's not like it's a secret how these businesses operate. And Carolee Evans wanted to make it clear that you should read those terms and conditions, because she's someone who makes use of that data.
So I'm one of those evil people that has before accessed the data that's available behind the firewall for strategy for clients, for healthcare, for various reasons. In those T's and C's, everything you do, it's a footprint, right? And it's not that you close down Facebook out of your browser and that's it. It's still on. The cookies are designed to track your entire web interaction. So if you just close down your Facebook browser, then go to a porn site, then go to a travel site, then go to maybe the My Health website, then go back to Facebook, theoretically, I know that. And I know that from a population stand, I know that from an area stand, I know that from a demographic stand. I can whittle down to the point where, and it's been proven, you can be identified.
Yes, you can be identified. And by who?
Anyone who pays. And that's the currency of Facebook and these platforms, is that for the right price, they will sell that data and they'll cut it to what you want to know and then give it to you on a platter. And they don't care how you use it because they've exchanged the currency, and then they'll go and find someone else.
Facebook is not free. It is not free. The people who actually really use Facebook pay a lot of money for that information that all of you have actually populated.
The corporate intrusion into your life in the United States that is quite different to what we experience here. And I was speaking to a lawyer in Minnesota last week who said that she'd gone down to her local convenience store to buy a packet of baby food for her boyfriend because he just had his wisdom teeth out. And she put that on her credit card. And about a week later, she started getting emails offering her baby food vouchers. Mm. She doesn't have babies. They'd got that information off her credit card, then got the email off the credit card company. I mean, I think if we were being intruded to that extent, I think Australians would probably arc up.
Well, here's a question.
We're going down that line.
Oh, we are definitely going down that line.
Well, not me personally, but from a marketing perspective, I mean, any chance to access someone and to think that, okay, if I can get some information from you, which is going to help me sell something, then I'm going to do it. So if you go into a shopping centre now and you've got Bluetooth on your phone, you will get ads coming up on your phone.
Can I play devil's advocate from back here? There will be some people who lead their lives and say, if I'm getting this stuff for free and the advertising is matching the way I lead my life, that's good.
That's Facebook's pitch.
And our devil's advocate there was John Kerrison from Sky Business News. He was actually our moderator on the night. Well, enough about the commercial aspects for a while. Let's head to Syria. As I said, Jessica Hill has been doing a lot of work on what's happening politically in the Middle East. And she told everyone in the room just how extraordinary the privacy-protecting measures were that some of the rebels, I suppose you would call them, in Syria were having to go to. Yes, they used Tor, T-O-R, the onion router. Now, if you've not encountered that before, it's a way of trying to keep your internet traffic anonymous. You connect to a Tor server using an encrypted link. Your data is bounced around at random between a whole network of other Tor servers around the world and comes out somewhere else before going on to its final destination. And the exact route changes every 5 minutes or so. So in theory, that helps keep your IP address hidden. But Tor isn't the only tool they're using in the Middle East.
So sometimes, especially in the border areas, they'll use foreign SIM cards from either Lebanon, Turkey, sometimes from Egypt, people who've left the country who've left the SIM cards. But in other cases, and kind of in a more grim instance, a lot of people are using SIM cards from people who've died, and they can't be tracked that way. But even still, they've got to be very careful. Some people only turn their phones on for an hour at a time and take the battery out and the SIM card out every other for the rest of the day. So it's very difficult.
But if people are trying to hide from the security forces by staying anonymous online, how does a journalist end up verifying that they are who they say they are and that the information they're passing on is true? Well, it turns out that it's actually not a technical thing.
So I think, like, throughout the last 9 or 10 months, we've had to be extremely careful about what we've picked up through social networking sites, and especially because, you know, I work for the ABC, our credibility is absolutely paramount. It's not okay to be wrong for a short amount of time. It's really, like, and especially because we were using quite unorthodox ways of getting in touch with eyewitnesses, really had to be careful that it was as verifiable as possible, with certain caveats, you know. So when we would see photos come in from someone, say they're in Homs, a town in Syria that's seen a lot of unrest, I think it's important if reporters are going to use these platforms that they are immersed in the platform and that they study it like a language, and that they have existing, as fast as they can, I guess, that you develop an understanding of who are the reliable people in this scene. So in the Syrian scene, there might be 3 or 4 human rights activists who are plugged into a lot of different activists in different towns on the ground. There might be people from exile, dissidents in exile who are also plugged in. So you would make sure if you got photos from a town, you would want to go to, well, you triangulate. It's something that people do in anthropology a lot. You go to at least three or four other people in that town who have access to that town and say, does this marry up with what you've been hearing, thanks Andy, from that location? Then you would want to possibly send those photos to those people, say, have you seen these doing the rounds as fake photos? There is sophistication in faking this stuff, but it's not that sophisticated. It's like it is still on a relatively amateur level. And there was an incident that we had that was on Media Watch a few months ago where Reuters had used a video that was purportedly from Syria showing Syrian security forces beating up a whole bunch of protesters. And that actually turned out to be from Lebanon, and it was actually 2 years previous. I found that out just by posting that video on Twitter and a Lebanese activist getting back in touch with me literally in 5 minutes and saying, no, I've seen that video before. It's not from Syria. So there are ways, if you're logged into a network, that you can verify this stuff. And if it's not, if it's looking fishy, don't report it. That's just, and I think a lot of people have come unstuck. Gay Girl in Damascus is a particular incident that I'm sure a lot of you have heard of, where people didn't go past the blog. They didn't get in touch with the gay girl or the person who knows the gay girl. And we tried for 2 days to get in touch with the person, anyone who'd been in personal contact with the gay girl, and no one had. So we didn't report it.
Well, we're getting away from technical things there, of course, into just basic human networks. But then, as my friend and colleague and futurist Mark Pesce says, it is the human network that makes the difference. It's just that all this technology allows us to connect with those networks globally, as Jessica Hill does when she's building up her contacts in places like Syria. Well, of course, Tor is important in that context, but it turns out that lawyer David Stewart is not a fan.
Can I just interrupt the hypothetical just for a moment? I actually utterly hate Tor with a passion and any type of proxy, IP proxies. And the reason is this. I act for two financial services companies, and they constantly have problems with phishing, as in the phishing with the PH in the front. And if you're a guy in France, as one of these guys was, and have managed to get hold of a domain name which, and this wasn't it, but say it was something like naboonline.net, and you start sending out emails to people in Australia saying, we're really sorry, but we actually need you to enter in your password here and update your details because we have had a technical glitch and we need to be able to confirm that your data is actually correct. When they come and see someone like me and we're trying to work out exactly who is responsible, that's extraordinarily difficult. And there's a real public hazard attached to that. So I have a lot of empathy for what you're saying and the sort of issues that you struggle with, but it creates just as many headaches for
all tools
ordinary
used for good and evil.
Absolutely, yes, entirely.
Well, David Stewart did outline another scenario which allowed him to use the tool of Facebook. I'll leave you to decide whether this is for good or for evil.
We had to try and find someone, and we wanted to serve them with some legal papers. And so
can you do that?
Yes,
you
honestly. Yeah, we found them.
Good
we found them, oddly enough, because we found them because we found on their Facebook site photographs of where their office is, looking out the window.
Well, as I said, the discussion at the Hotel Clarendon went for 2 hours or so, and the full version is over at media140.com. But to wrap up with a few notes here on Patch Monday, I guess we'll come back to sort of some of the bigger picture stuff. What do we want to be looking at in the longer term? Here was Jessica Hill's suggestion.
Greater literacy in these areas and teaching kids in school what rights they're giving up by getting on these platforms, what rights they actually have and the advantages of protecting those rights. And I think at the moment we're in this sort of jump time where, I mean, literally these platforms are like 4 and 5 years old. It's no wonder it's such a mess because it's something that's grown so quick, perhaps one of the fastest growing things in the history of mankind, that, you know, 600 million users of Facebook who've had 5 years to get their head around what it means for them to be members. And I think that this is going to if we look at over the next 10 or 15 years, I think literacy around this area, it's already starting to tip.
Yeah, I wonder where accountability and self-accountability lies in all of this. I think, you know, I wonder where we change from being a society where you would know your neighbour, where you would build up a trust, you would get to know them to understand whether you could trust them or not, or leave the keys with them or not. I wonder where, just with the advent of digital and the internet, which is built on the premise of sharing information and it functions on the fact that it can identify you and connect you, I wonder where we lost that self accountability of making sure that we read the T's and C's of Facebook, that we understand what the agenda is of Google, that we know that there's a thing called cookies, and that if we don't want to be tracked, that we clear them.
I think we're heading back towards that.
You don't have a right. You're absolutely right. You don't have a right. So this is when I actually take off my lawyer's robes and put on my Guy Fawkes mask and reveal myself as a raging anarchist. go off and on Facebook, you know, disinform. You know, put in information which is wrong and clear your cookies and use proxy servers. And, you know, if you're really that bothered by it, then go out and do all these things you can.
Well, what I find interesting there is a lawyer is actually recommending putting false information into your Facebook profile, which is actually explicitly against Facebook's terms and conditions. I mean, you are not allowed to lie on these platforms, and yet that's what privacy advocates tell us to do. Well, at about this point, a scenario occurred to me. I thought I'd put this question to the rest of the panellists.
If you, for whatever reason, were searching for a new partner, would you use your actual name as the profile name on the dating site?
Ooh!
Thank you, still Gary.
That's a sexy anonymous question.
Response. Gavin,
go for it.
Yes and no. And yes, if
depends
you want
who
to,
she is.
Yes, if you want it to be a meaningful, lasting relationship, then the okay. No, if you're into, you can think about the rest of it.
Okay, who gasped in this room? just about everybody.
Of course, you're probably not going to start out with your actual wallet name as your identity.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. No, I think you would, because if you went, say you're on RSVP, I'm married, by the way, but just, you know, say hypothetically, that you entered into a conversation with somebody, a meaningful conversation, and, you know, emailing back and forth, and then you met up with them, then you got to break it to them that it's not your real name. Immediately you're just like, you're suspect.
Yeah, but if your pseudonym was something like, you know,
I must admit, those answers really did strike me as, you know, a bit wrong. Maybe these people haven't been on dating sites. I mean, not that I have, obviously. This is purely a hypothetical thing, but surely you don't reveal everything about you to complete strangers all at once. Look, let's wrap it up. We've been going a while. Let's just take the last few summary comments from everyone on your right to anonymity online.
Over the coming decades, Jess, will we have a community in the West where people have a right to anonymity?
Well, you know, we're dealing with countries, we're dealing with companies. So rights, who declares the right and who monitors it, who governs it? Is it the UN? Does the UN declare a universal right? Who abides by it? I guess if we're going, like, the best that we have in terms of global rights are UN declarations that then countries sign up to and ratify and then bring into their own national law. So I would suggest that anyone besides people who have profit motives would be very nervous about denying people around the world the right to be anonymous online. I would certainly think that if we were starting to go down the road and that was what it came down to, a Supreme Court decision or some high court deciding whether or not anonymity was a human right, I think that would be something that people would have to dwell on for a long time. And I think that people would probably be very resistant to declaring it as not a human right. But I don't know. It's very hard to say.
still, in coming years, will people in the West particularly see a right to anonymity?
I think there's going to be a battle for such a right. Whether it succeeds or not, it's really hard to tell. There's too many forces at play at the moment. There are commercial forces who want you to open up. There are technologies right now that are being deployed that we haven't really thought through all the implications of. And I'll give just one example of that, which is face recognition technology. It's built into every Mac, in every copy of iPhoto, that if you put a photo in of someone and says, that's Susan Smith, then any photos you can pour in, it will identify Susan Smith. It's good enough to tell the difference between Susan Smith and her sister. That technology is being rolled out, well, is rolled out in Facebook. Google has said they already have equivalent technology, but they haven't turned it on yet because somehow Google on this occasion understood that there might be privacy implications about this. I have already heard at a conference former Commissioner of the Federal Police, Mick Keelty, point out that all this face recognition technology means that how do they have undercover cops in the future? Particularly when members of outlaw motorcycle gangs are already attending the graduations of new police officers at Goulburn and taking the photos of all of the newly graduated police officers.
Wow.
I'll leave you with that thought.
That's a good thought to leave us with. David, will we see a future where there's a right to anonymity on the internet?
My feeling about this is probably best reflected in what's currently happening in the UK, where you've got this enormous public reaction against phone tapping. And you've got a public inquiry and you've got celebrities talking about how they have had their privacy intruded upon, how miserable it is to have people tapping into your phones and listening to your conversations. And I think what will end up happening, my feeling on it, is that something awful will happen. That this information which is being aggregated, it will end up being used in such a way that something terrible will happen. And the thing with the law is that the law is slow, but it never sleeps. The law slowly drags itself along to a point where it actually addresses these sort of issues. And, you know, my feeling on it is that, you know, and I hope it doesn't happen to me or anyone else that I know, but, you know, something will come about from this data aggregation that will cause someone or a class of people great harm and will end up with some sort of legislative or regulatory remedy for it. I don't know when that will be, but I think that will eventually happen.
I think conversely to that, I think the emergence of big data and all of this information that's being gathered online, what if something wonderful happens from it? We've already seen gamers solve a protein from the HIV where they were given access to data and then challenged with finding this one protein. So I would just ask you to maybe look at the positives. I'm going to sound like such an evil marketer now. But there's for every negative, there's a positive. For every positive, there's a negative. I think we're so far down this garden path that we would literally have to, and it's been, we've got organisations building a second web. We would have to really look at how the web functions as its capacity now to make the decision and put barriers in place to allow the right to be anonymous online, because as it stands at the moment, I think it gets back to we have a right to want to be anonymous online, but the way that the web has been built specifically and functions by, and there's economics behind the web. I mean, largely the web functions because of capitalism, and we're so far down that path that we would almost need to rebuild it and restart and ask those serious questions about whether privacy and I can never say that word, but being...
Yeah.
But this is it. I mean, if we decide that... If we decide that the right to be anonymous is a basic human right, well, then let's put that in writing, let's ratify it, and let's restart everything.
And I think just as a last thought, just to say on Carolee's point, if we're serious about democracy, as Western nations claim to be, there are lots of pitfalls about democracy, but it's the best system that we have. And I think that if we're serious about democracy, those Western nations will protect the right to be anonymous online, because it's the best tool that they have to fight for those types of systems in places where that is not an equal right.
That's Jessica Hill from ABC Radio Current Affairs. Wrapping up that discussion on digital anonymity, you also heard from David Stewart from legal firm Raise, and from PR firm Text 100, Carolee Evans, and of course a bit of me, and a bit of host John Kerrison from Sky Business News. And as I said, that's just part of a much longer conversation, which you can go over to listen to at media140.com. And my thanks to Media 140 Australia for making that audio available to us. That's it for Patch Monday for another week. If you'd like to leave a comment on the program, head over to the website and type in some words. Or if you'd like to leave an audio comment for us to include on next week's program, then either Skype to Stilgerian or phone Sydney 02-8011-3733 and have your say. I'm not quite sure what our topic will be next week. There's an awful lot of things happening, but one thing I can tell you is that we will be back next Monday for another edition of Patch Monday. I'm Stilgerian for ZDNet Australia, and until then, have a good week.